Hi, it's Ada. In this episode, Alex and Pete discuss MIT's shocking revelation that 95% of Gen AI projects fail spectacularly after only 4 recording attempts, because apparently, operating basic technology is harder than implementing enterprise AI. They dissect why most companies are absolutely shit at turning flashy demos into actual business value. Explore the thriving shadow AI economy, where employees secretly use ChatGPT whilst IT departments have meltdowns, and conclude that maybe, just maybe, asking your staff what actually works might be more useful than another PowerPoint about AI transformation. Groundbreaking stuff.
And we are rolling. Welcome back to Groundhog Podcast, Pete.
Yes, indeed.
We are, for the listeners, this is now the fourth attempt to record this.
Yeah,
Oh, it's unbelievable. And I don't mean 4 attempts in one session, 4 attempts over 4 like separate sessions with just technical issues shutting us down to the point where we've had to change our recording provider. So this one hopefully will go better, but since we've never used this particular one, we're currently on Riverside FM, you know, it might work.
Yes, anything.
I'll tell you what, well, it really could. And I tell you what, like, I just give up. I mean, where do we go from here? If this one doesn't work either, we have to give up podcasting, Pete. That's our career's over. We'll just slink back into the shadows, back from where we came. So it has to work. So everyone listening, fingers crossed. Funnily enough, if you're hearing this and you're listening to my soothing tones right now, it means it worked. Hurrah! I might even go back and hooray! Let's all celebrate. Woo-hoo, woo! I might even go back in time and edit in some of the bits that we actually did manage to record in prior sessions, but I doubt there's anything there that we're not going to completely blow away right now. Yeah. So, our technical problems aside, we are going to, for the fourth time, try and talk about this now already aging research paper from MIT called The Gen AI Divide, The State of AI in Business 2025. And everyone's talking about it. We're probably last to get there, but there's lots to talk about here, and so we've had lots of attempts to get this right and we didn't, so let's start out, Pete, by reading the first bit of this executive summary, which I think gives us a window into what to expect for the rest of the report.
I mean, very much the first line sums it up, right, which is: despite $30 to $40 billion in enterprise investment into Gen AI, this report uncovers a surprising result in that 95% of organizations are getting zero return. So that's very much what they are saying. And they talk about this being a stark divide across buyers and enterprises and builders and so forth.
So to sort of place that into context, MIT, you might have heard of, and there's a few authors on the you can go find out for yourself, but they have derived this from interview surveys analysis of 300 public implementations. So it's not a little opinion piece, it's a pretty big paper, many pages, lots of citations, serious business, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to continue on that, they list just a paragraph on 4 patterns that emerge from these interviews and surveys, and they are, to quote, limited disruption, that only 2 out of 8 major sectors show meaningful structural change.
So the sectors as they define them. Over here on page 5 are energy and materials, advanced industries, financial services, consumer and retail, healthcare and pharma, professional services, media and telecoms, the two industries, the two sectors that have benefited, also, as it says, shown meaningful structural change are professional services, no shit, Sherlock, media and telecom, again, no shitting, Sherlock, right? So, yeah, that's a good start, right?
Yeah. So that's the sectors. The second point is that the second pattern is enterprise paradox. I mean, you just got to love that phrase, which is the big firms lead in pilot volume, but they lag in scale up.
So big firms are creating POCs and pilots, but they are failing to transform those into, proper projects and scaled up. Infrastructure or initiatives or whatever, right?
Yeah, and getting it into processes and structures, as it says. Okay, third one is investment bias. The budgets favour visible top-line functions over high ROI back office.
So it's sexy over boring, right?
Yeah.
Like, I guess... The way to think about that is, PowerPoint having the slide AI creator plugged into it, something visible and kind of cool, versus, creating some efficiency in your back office systems that, improve your supply chain or something like that, that could create serious gains, but will be invisible perhaps to your customers.
Yeah, exactly. Great. And the final pattern is implementation advantage, which they define as external partnerships see twice the success rate of internal builds.
Well, right. Don't build your own software if building software isn't your thing, right?
Yeah.
I think the major surprise about those four and the whole paper in general really is how unsurprising it is, right?
Yes.
So you could take any technological bubble or revolution that we've observed, going back from the internet earlier, even crypto, blockchain, all that type of thing. You could pretty much substitute any technological innovation that's taken hold and apply those last three to it, and no one would question it, particularly that last one, which is a bit yet another no shit Sherlock, right? But I think there's a gap here, of course, and as is often the case with a new technology, is that the products that you use and the frameworks and the technology suppliers will naturally and understandably take longer to integrate something like Gen AI into their software and roll it out, and to do so safely and to still adhere to their SLAs or licensing agreements or whatever. Therefore, businesses who want to take advantage of the new technology understandably will do some quick and dirty implementations in-house, but with a half an eye to just migrating that to their core supplier at some later date. I mean, that's just normal practice, and in my mind isn't controversial at all, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It very much reminds me of the early days of the internet coming in. I think big businesses were warned, this thing's coming, the internet, it's going to take off. You've got to get your business on there. And first there was just a bit of a groan and whatever. And then everyone got on there. And what they got on there was, a web landing page, which was, hello, I'm the company and this is what we do sort of deal. And there was a couple of years where that's kind of all big companies did, and I remember consultants go around saying, there's a bit more to it than that, you have to do this because now everyone else is doing it. And there was a feeling of that. And certainly I was in companies at the time that were late to it, but also companies that were going, yeah, well, how does this affect our business? You know, and food retail at the time going, yeah, well, it's all nice having a website, but people coming down and buy the groceries, right? And then here we are sort of 25 years later, you know, and you see everything has been, dare I coin such a phrase, but deliverized, you know, think of Deliveroo and Uber Eats and all this sort of thing. Suddenly you can get anything delivered, you know, you can.
And with the dark web, you can get literally anything delivered as well.
Yes, indeed.
And it's funny, really, because you talk about that as the early days of the internet, where it really was just read-only web. And I think we always sort of conflate the dot-com boom, which really was quite a bit later in the very late 90s and the early 2000s, as sort of where the internet started. But, of course, the dot-com boom was really about e-commerce, right? It was really about finding ways to monetize the web. And I started in technology as an employee of Amazon in 1998, one of the first 20 employees of Amazon in the UK, because I was working for an online bookseller, right? And that was when the internet started for me, apart from using Prestel on my ZX Spectrum 48K with rubber keys quite a long time before that. Anyway, we are digressing already, but I think the point here is if you take out the slightly wacky nature of what we're going to come to, you know, the particular flavor of bubbliness that we're in with Gen AI, it looks pretty much like any other boomy bubbly thing, right? I just don't see that this paper particularly says anything that would be considered controversial at the same sort of maturity period in any other technology boom. I think the issue is that the fact that any of this needs saying at all, right?
Well, that's what I find really bizarre. Yeah, really interesting. Because what we're saying here is that there's a technology change here, which on the hype side, you've got lots of people saying, oh, you know, it's going to change the world beyond recognition and sort of hyperbole like this. You know, the one third of jobs is going to be lost in the next 10 years, you know, all these big headlines. And then this report is saying, don't know anything about that. What I can tell you is that of 100 projects started, only 5 have made it across the line with any sort of meaningful impact. And that's, and as we'll get into in a minute, that's because it's quite difficult. And the shiny demo of something which, it, you know, looks and to a certain extent is totally amazing is much harder to turn into, as you say, something that you can monetize and actually has a positive impact on your business. So how do you take this amazing technology that can do this really good stuff and actually apply it to your business and benefit from it is not just a case of plug it in, turn light on. It's a case of, oh, the plug doesn't even, I've got a 3-pin plug. This thing's from Europe. It's got a 2-pin plug. So I can't even get started, you know, because the demo was shown was somebody had a converter plug and we didn't buy any of those. You know, it's, we can push any sort of analogy there, but it really feels like that. And, you know, as we move through his report, you know, the first sort of chapter is, you know, the disruption reality behind the divide.
I want to get on to the next section, but I do want to quickly pick up on some of your usage of language there, which is just how fucking amazing this shit is, right? And we're going to continue through this report with a notable flavor of cynicism and perhaps pessimism, but I was talking to someone just today who was using one of the models, saying, "Well, this thing just doesn't work. It doesn't do what it's supposed to. It comes out with nonsense." And that's correct, right? I'm not contradicting that. But sometimes you just want to say to people, "Yeah, I get it, but how amazing is it that they can do this at all?" Right?
Yes.
Because this almost came out of nowhere. You and me working back in the day, good decade ago, on stuff like Word to Vec. And we were talking about the spooky action that we were seeing using the word embeddings from that, and the calculus you could apply on them and get really interesting results. And then, you know, suddenly, almost out of the blue, it felt like with GPT-3, we've got something that can pass as intelligent. And there was, to the public, there was nothing in between.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to do a whole episode on how spectacularly amazing it is that these things can do what they do. Now, is that useful is a very different question, right? Magic is still magic, right? You know, is David Copperfield or the late, great Paul Daniels, were they useful? Well, they were entertainment. They created magic. We all knew that there was some, you know, flavor of misdirection happening, but it was still cool, right? Very few people built whole enterprises on that. And I think, you know, even if it is useless, which it isn't, but even if it was, it's still amazing. You know what I mean?
And it's holding those two things in your head at the same time, which I think is the real trick when we're talking about things like Gen AI, because it can do so many amazing things and yet it can fail so spectacularly on what appears to be an easy thing.
Yes. Well, let's go on to the five myths about Gen AI in the enterprise. Do you want to read the first one?
Yeah, five myths. So number one, AI will replace most jobs in the next few years. There you go. I was heading that out right at the start. Research found limited layoffs from Gen AI and only in industries that were already affected significantly be up by AI. So that's quite interesting that there's kind of two things mentioned, Gen AI and AI. And there is no consensus among executives as to hiring levels over the next 3 to 5 years. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I think, so if we go back to our list of industries or sectors or what we're calling them, the two that were most affected by their definition of meaningful structural change were professional services and media and telecom. Now, if we think about, pure benefit, well, professional services, consultancies are certainly not losing out at the moment, are they, right? Yeah. I mean, this is consultancy fodder to the extreme. This has got McKinsey, you know, getting really quite excitable for how much they can mine businesses for. But it's more the media and telecom that relates to this point here, where it says that only in industries that are already affected significantly by AI. And media, I don't know about telecoms, but I can certainly see media in terms of, you know, creatives being unseated, copywriters, things like translators, people doing subtitles, I guess, on movies or TV shows. You know, I'm just picking ones that come randomly to mind, but I think the media industries are going to be, I don't know when I say gutted, but they're going to be very different industries going forward. And some of the signs of that predate Gen AI, but it's going to really accelerate that. And that's the point that's being made here, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we think about media, yes. And if we think about any sort of industry that relies on things like call centers, right, are going to be affected, but nowhere else. And that's quite a lot, right?
I think the other thing here, the hidden thing here for me is that, you know, it talks about already being affected significantly by AI. Now, as we know, you know, it's been knocking around for 10 years or so now. And, you know, the adoption of AI has been slow, and, you know, the move into data driven has been slow by existing companies because they suffer from the innovator's dilemma as always, which is, you know, we're a big company, we're getting rich and running, with a decent profit how we are. And it's not in their interest to change that because they've already got a competitive advantage over other people due to size or efficiency. And so trying out something new, which means a change to that process, which is, you know, all cost to begin with, and high risk and not sure what it's going to give me, doesn't encourage larger sustained companies to make that innovation. And they tend to only make it when new players come along. And obviously we've seen this a lot in technology in the last 30 years, is new players come along and they are effectively born in the new technology, pick the best of the old stuff, layer on a whole load of new stuff, and suddenly you have this new way of doing things, which suddenly kills everybody else who, you know, the big incumbents. So you suddenly go, all right, well, we need to do that. And you say, well, in order to do that, you know, you need to be data first and you need to have provenance of your data, know where it comes from. You need to have one source of truth. You need to know that net sales means net sales, not net sales minus costs or pluses or minus that. Do you have that? And they all go, no. And you go, well, you've got to get that first. And they say, oh, okay, well, can we do that? Well, that's £50 million, please. And then everyone gets up off the floor, says, wow, and how long will that take? Oh, 3 years. And they suddenly realize that in order to get where the new guys have got, who were born with, you know, data driven, because that was how they started their companies, they suddenly realize they're way behind. And I'm sure some people have been active in doing that. And some companies, as we know, definitely have been inactive and trying to ignore it and say, well, you know, that cost is so high, we don't see the benefit. And so either very slow or not moving at all to getting their data in order, because in order to really bring Gen AI into your company successfully, you're going to need a lot of these building blocks in place, like decent data, a scrub data, data that you understand, common across all business units in your company. And I think a lot of companies aren't in that place. And so you can do a POC on some scrub data that you had for this small team here with 200 documents. And then when you say, oh, yeah, well, let's put that across the whole company, you go, well, where's all your documentation? Oh, we don't know. Is it scrubbed? No. And that is suddenly where you get a really, really big pain point.
To a degree, you've sort of jumped a bit of reasoning there, because you know, the innovator's dilemma, as sort of personified here, is it's a bit of an edge case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Which implies there's some sort of fixed state, or to put it another way, we choose not to jump on this particular innovation vehicle, bandwagon, whatever you want, for whatever strategic reasons, and we don't want to break things that are, you know, we'll fix things that aren't broken. But there is some positive and clear end state that someone is making a decision to not pursue, right? Whereas that's absolutely not clear, right? And it's not clear, and it's clear from the 95% of failed POCs data point the use cases here aren't clear cut. There's, I think that a lot of people have got a hammer and were hitting nails with it, right? And not achieving much of any value because they weren't working towards something. They were working from something towards, well, anything, right? Just find something that we can use this amazing technology to do with, right? And sort of hitting roadblocks and issues with things like consistency and accuracy and so on, and largely giving up. Now, I think that once a few of those proof of concepts would have cleared and been put in the recycle bin, the people commissioning them were starting to think, well, what is the killer app here, right? What is the thing? What is this, the sunlit uplands that we are working towards? And sort of concluding that they probably didn't ever exist, right? Because the Gen AI, despite its amazingness, doesn't have a clear value proposition for most businesses, right? And certainly where it can be seen as having some value, for example, the type of use case that you outlined there, let's call it like rationalizing and remobilizing our internal documentation stores, right? The sort of thing that intranets have been sucking at for decades, right? I can see that as a use case, and let's call it a viable one, right? As you're suggesting, the heavy lifting that would be needed to make that happen and to do so in a secure and reliable way is likely to massively outweigh the potential benefits of doing that, right? And I think most executives would be cynical of the value that their historical information sets are going to offer. It's very industry dependent, but like, you know, a lot of businesses will look at for those obvious use cases and conclude very quickly that there's no sunlit uplands here. It's just not really a thing that we would bother doing, right? Yeah. Or just wait until someone comes out with a product that just makes it easy for me to do that, right? And which brings us to that was the final point, the implementation advantage point of the prior four bullets. You know, you can see why these decisions are being made because they're rational.
And that, you know, is really interesting because effectively the challenges that are there, as in we're going to have to make a change to you know, our existing processes, like say the documents maybe, that's got to happen whether you are doing an experiment and trying to find out what the benefit is or whether you know what the benefit is up front and you're gunning for it. And either way, you can't move forward past, you know, a proof of concept if you haven't got your data and your company structure in the right lineup. And of course, if it's the second one where you don't really know what the outcome is going to be, because like you say, putting a chatbot over here on our internal documents, how much value does that really give us? Then as you say, you're going to go, well, there's no benefit in that. But even to find out, well, what might the benefit be? You've got to make that investment. So you're a bit knackered either way, because if you don't do it, if you don't make your changes, you can't possibly experiment. But if you don't know what the outcome of that experiment is going to be, why would you make the investment?
Yes, chicken and egg, right?
Yeah.
There's so many rabbit holes we could get lost down here. Because you made so many points there, my brain is swimming. So rather than get lost down more rabbit holes, I'm going to read the next bullet point, right?
Yeah.
Actually, this one's a bit of a non-bullet point because it just for completeness, because we already said it. The next myth is generative AI is transforming business, whereas the reality is adoption is high, but transformation is rare. Only 5% of enterprises have AI tools integrated in workflows at scale. 7 of 9 sectors show no real structural change, right? We've already done that. So next one, number three, is enterprises are slower at adopting new tech. The myth. The reality is enterprises are extremely eager to adopt AI, and 90% have seriously explored buying an AI solution, right? So that's an interesting sort of counter to some of the sentiment we've been putting out up until now, with the, you know, the innovator's dilemma and so on. You know, it just shows how immediately intuitive, for example, large language models are, because I think people, and we'll come back to this one very specifically in a minute, people can immediately see I type in this and it gives me that, and that's really interesting. Oh, cool, that I could never do that before, right? And thinking, well, if it can do that, what else can it do, right? And they're exactly right to think that. But the problem you've got with Gen AI, particularly language models, is that there's a hockey stick. So it's very, very easy to do something okay, but it's very, very hard to do something really well at scale and consistently. It's brutally hard, and in some cases some people will argue impossible given the current technology stack. And so I'm not surprised to find that adoption is high, especially given the hype, right? But I'm also not surprised that that's not managed to propagate or scale.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, this is all about, you know, and the tech, you know, as it said in that, you know, enterprises are keen to adopt the technology. It's like, yes, but it's not the technology that does the transforming. You know, that's an enabler. The transformation comes in how you apply it to your business, your processes, to become more efficient, to create new products. And, you know,
well, it's also a bit it's a bit nonsensical, isn't it, too? It's like, I'm eager to be rich beyond my wildest dreams, right? There's a little bit of a gap between my wishes and, you know, eagerness and reality of the world, right? Do you want to read number four?
Yeah, so number four, we have the biggest thing holding back AI is model quality. So this is a myth, is model quality, legal data and risk. What's really holding it back is that most AI tools don't learn and don't integrate well into workflows. Well, just as I was saying.
I think this is a really, really, really both not at all interesting statement and an absolutely fascinating one, right? And I'll tell you why. Because firstly, if you understand these things, how these things work, there's nothing controversial there, right? That's so obvious, right? But I think that for normal people, yes, for normal people who haven't been sucked into this maelstrom of oddity, that when you think about things like AI and machine learning, well, the clue's in the title, right? That these things learned from the internet. They learned from everything, every bit of text that was ever written and digitized. They've learned from it, right? And then so to say that these things don't learn, I think to some people is like, well, of course they learn, right? How do they know anything? And I have so many conversations with people who are like, yeah, but ChatGPT knows me, right? It remembers things. Right. And I'm like, and we've done this before. We've chatted about this before. Right. Well, I'm like, no, it doesn't. And I had at least once to go back and like literally try and relearn everything I knew because someone was so insistent that ChatGPT knew them and remembered them. And I'm like, have I just misunderstood? Did I miss something really big here? Right. Am I like a literal complete loss of confidence? Like maybe I don't understand this after all. And then, it didn't take me long to figure out actually they were using the ChatGPT app and it just simply does some local RAG, right? So it keeps information about you on the local, on your phone or whatever and ferries that up and down. And basically every time you message it, it's the first time it's ever heard from you because these models are static, right? Like GPT-4.1 and GPT-4.0 and GPT-5, yes, they are, they have been trained separately and, you know, sequentially they have learned in between model training rounds, but a model training round takes like 6 months, right? And then that model is static for the rest of its life, barring perhaps some fine tuning either done on in this case, OpenAI's side or maybe, you know, you or your business have. But I think people get really sort of confused about the fact that both, firstly, because the ChatGPT app does seem to remember them, and secondly, well, this thing learned. It's an AI. Of course it learns, right? But no, it doesn't. From a perspective of plugging it into a piece of enterprise software, it isn't going to learn. It's not going to remember, and you have to tell it everything every single time, right? And that, I think, is a major roadblock, and you can see why it is, right? And this is the expectation gap. People are using ChatGPT and expecting what that gives them at scale in enterprise software and then are being disappointed when it doesn't offer that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, that learning stuff, your personal, I see that as akin to, you know, cookies on the internet, you know. It's storing your browser behavior. So effectively it can read through you know, your browser history, let's say for a month, and then it can infer from that what your interests might be, and it will record what your interest is. Whereas, of course, the raw data is just a bunch of websites. It's much more scary seeing the inference it makes and, you know, how accurate that might be, because it's like someone reading through your browsing history, spending a couple of hours and going, oh, yeah, yeah, you like model trains.
But digital marketing, you know, digital marketing has been doing that for a decade, longer, right?
Yes,
15 years. Using AI, in using the broadest sense of that term, to infer things about people from their browser history, right? That's how you get haunted on the internet, because you once thought about buying a watch or something, and suddenly now you're seeing adverts for that everywhere. And I think that's partly what's allowed some of the more pernicious edges of this to get through the door. But the advertising, digital advertising industry is highly regulated, right? Whereas nothing like that's been applied to Gen AI. Right? It's like, oh, no, we're using language models, so we don't have to do laws. Sorry. You know what I mean? Let me read the last of the myths. The best enterprises are building their own tools, is the myth. And the reality is internal builds fail twice as often. Well, I don't know. It's almost not worth mentioning again. Of course, that's the reality. I think it's a completely understandable reality. I think businesses are doing what they need to, given the nascent state of the industry, and of course they're going to fail. I mean, if you are a company providing accountancy services to medium-sized enterprises, what your skill is not, is building bloody software. So you cobble stuff together, perhaps using Claude code on VS Code to put some, you know, software out there that might scratch an itch and bridge a gap until your accounting software provider catches up, but that's destined for the bin, full stop, right? And so in terms of value, brings me on to literally the next portion of the paper. 3.3, the shadow AI economy, a bridge across the divide. So what this says, and should I read this again? Behind the disappointing enterprise deployment numbers lies a surprising reality. AI is already transforming work, not just through official channels. Our research uncovered a thriving shadow AI economy where employees use personal ChatGPT accounts, Claude subscriptions and other consumer tools to automate significant portions of their job, often without IT knowledge or approval. Now, again, we can hark back to something like the advent of internet chat. And I don't mean IRC, I mean a bit later when stuff like Slack and then, you know, WhatsApp and stuff started to really take hold. Group chats became the norm, and it took really quite a lot of time for businesses to adopt those paradigms, as well as the paradigms of social media. And now we have, you know, Teams, and it's utter ubiquity. I think again, it's not surprising that there is this shadow economy of employees using this stuff. That they are ahead of the curve, based, you know, ahead of the curve in front of their own employers. That's not particularly unusual. It applies to the internet, it applies to chat, it applies to probably almost every big innovation, technological innovation. What I think really intrigues me here, and also highlights a massive hole in the visibility here, of businesses is and a massive opportunity, is that if an employee has figured out how to make themselves more efficient, proficient, whatever you want, productive with ChatGPT on their phone or whatever, you know what I mean? I think that's huge. That's a huge deal, right? But these same employees And you know, we talk a lot, especially in the UK, because of our low productivity as a nation. I won't go into what exactly that means, but it's a pretty big thing. If employees are on their own finding tools that help them improve their productivity, then businesses really need to listen to that, right? If you're sitting around going, well, how can I make ChatGPT make my business better? Why don't you go and ask your employees that are already doing that? Well, they're not going to tell you because you've got an IT team or in fact an HR team or anything you like that's going to say, but you can't put our data into that. That's not safe, right? Yeah. And that's also correct. That's rational. So I think we, you know, businesses everywhere need to create an amnesty, right, where people can anonymously articulate where they've used Gen AI to improve their productivity, and then just fucking do that, right? Just do what's already being done and make it safe and make it better, right? Find a supplier that can help you do that. And I think if there's a route to transformation that really will make Gen AI prove its value in the enterprise, that's the route, right? But yeah, it's got to be safe for the employees to be able to say that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the onus on the companies is to provide flexible tools that provide that security that people can use that are as good as the off-the-shelf free versions. So, you know, have some form of, you know, cookie history that we're talking about, in inverted commas, knows you and knows the work you do. You know, and we've experimented with that. It's not hard to do, but you need to do it en masse. And people need to be able to, you know, personalize it to an extent, you know. But if you give that level of tool set, which, you know, is a little bit of a challenge, but it's not insurmountable. And I know companies which are already doing this and people working in those companies. And, you know, they say exactly that. Well, you know, I've now got, you know, there's a tool for developers to use. And now there's a general tool where I can ask general questions and it's okay to put sort of, you know, sensitive data to a point into it, because it's an enterprise, you know, model, you know, which we saw, you know, some years ago as well. And we talked about when we first started seeing this, I remember you said exactly that. You know, there's two things. Is one, you need to get employees on this. It needs to be held internally and, you know, and secure so that data is not leaking out. And two, you need to be recording, from a enterprise standpoint, the prompts and the things that people are doing, and then looking at how you can share that across disparate people, build up libraries of prompts, whatever it may be, so that you are, as an enterprise, learning from the general population of your workers, of what they're doing. But also there's always going to be some leaders, right? Some innovators. And, you know, you want to be able to say, oh God, are these guys over here doing it? You know, and then publish that. And then, you know, 75 other people go, oh, great, that works for me as well. Next thing you know, you've got 100 people working in a new way and being much more efficient. That's where you want to be. And you want to be providing, you know, you want to be the, I won't say glue, because you want to be the opposite of glue. You want to be, you know, the oil in the cogs to make everything work well, rather than deciding what each person should be doing and then explicitly laying down, you know, that sort of control and command model of the past. Let's do an experiment, find out what the use case is, roll that use case across to everybody. No, you need to provide the ability for people to discover and share their own use cases, and then over time begin to consolidate that and realize how your business is changing. And that's exactly what this is saying. You know, it's saying this is what is already happening. So it's happening anyway. You can either ignore it and pretend it's not happening, which puts you at massive risk, or you can embrace it and you know, leverage it.
Well, worse, you can legislate it out of existence. So not only do you not get the benefit of people doing this side of desk, right? you are not integrating what they've learned into your systems. Therefore, you're shutting down the productivity gain and you're shutting down an individual's ability to perform and be happy and comfortable in their job in the way that they already know they can be. There's a quote on page 12 that illustrates this in the same report. Our purchased AI tool provided rigid summaries with limited customization options. With ChatGPT, I can guide the conversation and iterate until I can get exactly what I need. The fundamental quality difference is noticeable. ChatGPT consistently produces better outputs, even though our vendor claims to use the same underlying technology, right? So if we assume that their vendor isn't bullshitting, they've basically hobbled ChatGPT, right? And I can think of lots of good reasons for doing that, but at what cost, right? And there's going to be so much of this at what cost, right? We have to adhere to these extremely rigid data protection policies. Therefore, we can't get the productivity gains. You simply can't have it. Now, is that the right course of action? Well, you'd have to look at it at a case-by-case basis. Should businesses be as open-minded as possible about the use cases versus potential repercussions? I'm certainly not, suggesting that company secrets or PII data or whatever should be played fast and loose with. But a lot of company information protection strategies and rule sets are needlessly hard and harsh and will immediately rule out the use of things like this. And therefore, chuck your productivity gains in the bin. Oh, but we managed to integrate an AI chatbot into our front end web page. Oh, well done, guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's what we've talked about in the past, in the last couple of episodes about personalized software. And I remember we mentioned and discussed then that the real challenge for enterprises is that's not how software has worked in the past. It's a one size fits all with a little bit of local customization. Maybe you can reskin it, put different colors on it, or have a different language or something, but essentially you're working off the same base. You do the process in this order. But what we're talking about here is, flexible tools that allow you to discover new ways to do things. And it's not going to be driven from the center. It's going to be driven from the edges. And the infrastructure has got to be able to support that level of flexibility. And it's just not used to it. It's not built for it. It's, as you say, there's needless, cumbersome rules, and they're there for good reasons. But these are some of the things that really need to be challenged. How do you keep a secure, data in a world where data is really going to help me innovate my next efficiency and my next process?
And let's be clear about this. OpenAI and other businesses stole the internet, right, to create these models. And so, in some ways, we've got some data protection stuff going on here. I'm sorry that ship has sailed, mate. You know what I mean? Again, accepting sensitive PII, highly sensitive, highly protected data. Of course, you're not sticking that through, a Gen AI workflow, unless it's incredibly well insulated. But a lot of the time it's like, our content is our content. We don't want it out there. It's like, well, no, mate, I'm sorry, but it's already out there. I'm just picking up another quote from here because it illustrates another point. A VP of procurement at a Fortune 1000 pharmaceutical company. If I buy a tool to help my team work faster, how do I quantify that impact? How do I justify it to my CEO when it won't directly move revenue or decrease measurable costs? I could argue it helps our scientists get their tools faster, but that's several degrees moved from the bottom line impact. Now, part of me is like, well, welcome to our world, guys. Come on. Right. Yeah. How long have we worked in and around data, particularly analytics and analysis and data science, and had this same bloody problem? I was like, well, why are you here? What are you doing here? With all your dashboards and your analysis and your pretty charts, you know, how can I prove that that is, you know, delivering revenue or cost savings? And it's like, well, I can't. But you just made that decision that added 10% to the, turnover of your business based on a piece of analysis I did that uncovered some information you didn't have before, right? So that 10% is attributable to me, right? But what happens is then the person who made that decision takes all the credit, and us backroom people get sort of like elbowed out the way, right? And it's fine. It is what it is. This is not me having a gripe. Well, actually it is, but like it's not exactly new, right? And it's not exactly individual to us. But I think really, you know, we're especially in the UK where investment money is scarce, that you really have to justify what the value is. And so we can talk about Gen AI POCs or prototypes or whatever not being approved because perhaps, say, they just can't do what they are supposed to do because of, you know, inaccuracies or inconsistencies, whatever, or scalability, something like that. But the reality, I think, quite a lot of it is going, well, that's beautiful. You just built something amazing there, Pete. It blows my mind. But how the hell is that going to make me any money? How the hell is that going to save me any money? You know, it looks great, but can you just file it and go work on something, you know, useful, please, right? And I would be quite amazed if a significant amount of those POCs ended in it just being, actually, you did exactly what you said you were going to do. I just can't see the value, right, to our business.
And I think that's where the conversation, you know, becomes really hard because people are like sort of shrugging their shoulders, you know, well, you know, what are you doing for me? And I've, you know, it feels exactly the same here. If you're already of that mindset, you're going to be looking for ways that Gen AI and AI can help your business. And if you're not, you're going to be asking it to justify it. And that justification for a general tool which helps your team for an hour or so a week is hard to justify. Well, where's that on my bottom line? Where's my measure for that? You know, and the answer is, well, there isn't one. But do you want those efficiency gains or not? And I'm sure we're going to talk through another report that came out recently, the Google one. And that's around, office-based tools, if you want to call them that, productivity tools, and how their AI plugged into that, the whole Gemini and Google suite. And I think they've produced a report, you know, talking about that. And I just had a quick look at one of the headlines, you know, and it was talking about, you know, targeting 100 hours a year saving, which seems sort of paltry, really, you know, 100 hours per person. You know, doesn't feel like, I mean, that probably does add up, you know, if you put it into a spreadsheet and stuff, but it doesn't feel like a lot. I don't think.
Well, it's not sexy numbers, is it? You know, I mean,
I think as an executive, it also I wouldn't be impressed with that, you know.
No, and it's also not, you know, reducing my workforce size or whatever necessarily. We'll come back to that one because I haven't actually read it properly yet. But
no, exactly.
I'm quite interested in that report and some of the parallels I see with other things that Google have done. But no more digressions, right? We need to wrap this up. This report isn't all doom and gloom. There is some real practical stuff on here. Section 5, crossing the Gen AI divide, how do the best builders succeed? Which this bit I find really, again, interesting, but a little bit no shit. Organizations on the right side of the Gen AI divide share a common approach. They build adaptive embedded systems that learn from feedback. And I think that this, as someone who is an AI agent power user, for me, it's like, well, obviously, that, I mean, I sort of don't see the other use cases anymore, apart from, you know, asking ChatGPT the right recipe for pizza dough, which is a proxy for search, right? All other use cases for me are agentic, right? A multiple step and involve me trying to coerce systems into remembering things, right? And using the things that they do well to mitigate for the things that they do badly, right? Which is remembering things. And I think that too many people still see Gen AI or language models as one-shot entities, whereas the reality is it's an ongoing dance. I feel myself a bit more like a shepherd than you know, a conductor, right? With where the orchestra wants to do and will try its absolute hardest to do exactly what you're telling it to do. Whereas if you're herding sheep, you've got a dog running around, perhaps a couple of dogs, and you're doing a whistle, and you're trying to get them in, and you know, the odd sheep has buggered off and is chewing on some grass at the edge of the field and stuff. You don't lose your mind and go, right, that's, I'm going to give up sheep, right? You just figure out how to get the sheep back, right? And so there's this first barrier people hit that, oh, it didn't do this one thing right for me, so fuck Gen AI forever. And then the other one is, it has to do it first time, and it sort of has to do it all in one thing, when, you know, really the right way to build tools and applications here is to be adaptive and to use methods to reinforce things like memory from the ground up. Right. I know, I get that that's hard on mature code bases, but wherever you can, educating the AI by giving it indicators in the right place to remind it that it needs to pay attention to as you go along, as it's building out things or completing supply chains or building code or whatever, you just get used to saying, not only that you need to give it a little bit of extra information than perhaps you otherwise would, but also you need little cookies everywhere, right? In actually not such a different way to the internet cookie, in the you know, well, this bit of the file system over here is all the bits that relate to, you know, my writing on this podcast, right? And actually, when I'm in there, that the root of that directory has an agents.md or something in it that says, you know, says to the agent, here's the zone you're in at the moment. You're still in the Alex zone, but you're in the Alex bit of the Alex zone that relates to the Confusion Matrix podcast, right? So things need to be contextual. You need to behave in a certain way around this, in this area, right? And it's a somewhat oversimplified example, but my point being, you start getting used to be putting little indicators and cookie trails everywhere that are basically permanent to give the model hints and memory and things like that, as well as sort of RAG type interactions, and maybe you're doing some fine tuning, and then you just need to get used to talking to the models in certain ways to get the right thing out of them. And so that's at a sort of a single user interpersonal level, but it scales. How do you then, you know, build this into your supply chain workflow in such a way that it can remember, right? That you've put little data entities here and there that make sure that it's doing the right thing and it's remembered certain things it needs to do, right? You know, yeah. How often does my agent forget to create a new Git branch when it's doing some more development on the code base, right? Well, often is the answer. So what can I now do? I don't give up. I don't say bollocks to ChatGPT. I just figure out a way so that it's, and as does my agent provider, figures out a way to make sure it's constantly reminded of things like that, right? And yeah, we can hit context length problems, blah, blah, blah. These are just things to solve, right? It's not, and I think there's so much of this black and white mentality here in that, oh, it got Elvis's birthday wrong, so it's all crap, right? Really? Yeah. Is that where we're at, honestly?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've, you know, there's definitely a change in mentality, you know, and that's part of what this whole thing represents. You know, it's that from, you know, we talked about it before, from, you know, deterministic. You know, I've got a tool, that tool will always do things right, to, well, I've got a tool, it'll get things right most of the time. And, you know, I've now got to account for that. Oh, what, you mean just like humans? Oh, yeah, exactly right. And, you know, as you say, you know, there are ways to lean into that. I was thinking about this just recently when one of the truly amazing things of them is, you know, you can pause in a conversation and pick it up 3 days later and it acts like there's no pause at all, which is definitely not what humans do. But of course, part of the reason is because you're not having a conversation at all. You're having a one-time chat, and each time you're adding on what you've previously said, which obviously would be laborious to do with humans. So, you know, that's both its power and its, you know, its shortfalls. In that what it means is that when you use your agent today to do a piece of work, when you use that agent tomorrow, you think of it like you think of it as agent plus one day, but it's not, it's like a brand new staffer coming in again. I'm not comparing what it did yesterday with what it did today. It's a brand new thing coming along that had the same information and it performed a bit differently, you know, and then as you say, all right, well, what information can I add to it? That will help it. Next time round. But the next time round it comes in, it's like a brand new member of staff coming in. But the amazing thing is how much it can pick up, you know, in that fraction of a second when you give it a task and it reads 72 different cookie notes and then says, all right, well, I'm doing this then. And then it actually performs reasonably well out of it. Because when it comes back the next day, well, it's a brand new person doing all of that again. The fact that it performs reasonably the same again is quite amazing. So, you know, I think that again is quite helpful. It's a new person every time. And the reason why it in inverted commas remembers as well, because you wrote everything down for it.
You know? Well, and you know what it's like, don't you? It's the Christopher Nolan film Memento, right?
Yeah, indeed.
And so he's reliving the same day basically. Well, he's a chronic amnesiac, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's not the only film like this, but it's the one. And he's got tattoos all over him to remind him of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, at least we don't have to do that.
Well, in a way, we sort of are, I think, in a sense. When you start to build these, agentic environments, because let's be clear, on day one, you've pointed OpenAI, one of the OpenAI models at it. At day two, you've pointed Claude towards it. Day three, you've pointed Gemini towards it, right? So you might say that the model hasn't remembered in between, but you might not even be using the same model. It might be a different junior developer walking through the door,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so you do have these tattoos. And so is the tattoos all over Guy Pearce's body giving him the whole story every time? No, it's just clues. And that's the sort of way I see, when I was talking about cookies and stuff, you just leave things around to make sure that the model, oh yeah, yeah, no, I remember now, there's that thing and that thing and that thing, right? And so you do. So it's not such a terrible analogy. And I think that more people, more general business users, if they really fully understood the amnesiac nature of models, would be a lot more forgiving and start to use them in much smarter ways, because, you know, this stuff is surmountable, and the value of surmounting these problems is so big on an individual level. The jury's out on, you know, the transformation of humanity and, you know, the conquering by a malignant super intelligent sentient AI, but you know, there's a lot of value to be gained from here if people can cross that gap, right? And it's purely a psychological one, because the tools are all there, right? Everything there if you need it. And if you tune into these models the right way psychologically, then I personally find it all really intuitive, and have done for quite a long time now. My brain is very well attuned to how the models work. It's just something about the way that they operate just really, really gels with my autistic, ADHD, dyslexic, slightly odd, warped, neurological makeup, shall we say.
Yeah.
I'm going to cut just one more point, because you had the two sort of closing arguments here. That one was the best build, how the best builders succeed, how the best buyers succeed. Organizations that successfully cross the Gen AI divide approach AI procurement differently. They act like BPO clients, not SaaS customers. They demand deep customization, drive adoption from the front line, and hold vendors accountable to business metrics, right? So this is literally the inverse of how the builders succeed. Is basically you get the builders to do that, right? So you demand that they build customized technological entities that have the memory and the capability that you want. And knowing, and this is back to the personalized software thing, that is these days a lot more viable to build something that's highly customized. So demand customization, demand something that fits your need, and don't let them, you know, milk you financially for it. Get them on board to take some of the risk, right? And just do it bloody properly. Again, nothing new here, right?
No,
it's just exactly. Got a slightly AI flavor.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. Well, you heard it here first, Tattoo GPT, and which we'll be bringing out. And, of course, we'll have the headline, and that will be Remember Sammy Jenkins, I believe, is the main name.
But is that what his name is? It's in Memento. No, it's not. Is this in Memento?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking at IMDb. His name's Leonard.
Yeah, Leonard. And but the guy he tattoos that he has to remember the story of is Remember Sammy Jenkins.
Oh, I see. Got you. Oh, yeah. Right. You're right. Sammy Jenkins played by... Oh, I see. See, I don't remember any of this crap. So I'm going to have to go and watch it. I'll add it to the queue. Or either that, I'll just go and get ChatGPT to just recount it all to me. And then I don't have to watch it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Right, we did all of that. Thank you, MIT. I look, for closing thoughts on this. I don't know if we've come across being disparaging of the report itself. I think this is excellent and timely, right? And I'm really pleased that any organization had the intelligence, the wherewithal, and the bravery to just come out and say this, right? It's not all gloom. But it is very honest. It does offer solutions. It's not, there's no panacea here, but it's an excellent and very timely report that I think anyone running a business should have read, right?
Yes.
And if haven't, just don't trust us. Go and read this. It's really, really worth it. So well done, MIT. Woo-hoo! any thoughts yourself?
No, I agree. And, you know, we may have been a bit, well, I've seen all this before, but it still doesn't mean it shouldn't be said, you know, and these are real findings. This isn't just a bunch of people saying, oh, well, this is what you need to get technology over the line. We've known that for 40 years. This is like, yeah, well, we went and surveyed people and they're having problems, and they're having problems for these reasons. And perhaps the reasons aren't massively different, you know, which again, as you say, gives you hope because a lot of technology has been implemented in the last 40-50 years, so we know there is a way through this, and so yeah, let's make it happen.
Yeah, people, high fives, woohoo, we're gonna do this, people, we're gonna do it. If not, I'll just keep doing it. I'll keep noodling around with agents and making fun little apps that please me, and that'll be fine. So it's win-win for me.
Yeah,
so we're all good. Okay, good. Right. Well, I've no idea what we're doing next time. So tune in and find out. It will be so exciting, though.
Indeed, it will be. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much. And see you soon.
Right. See ya. Bye.
Confusion Matrix. Confusion.